Well, good morning. When Greg introduced me, Dr. Thornbury, I was really excited about hearing that guy speak until I realized that I was the one that had to get up here. But yeah, that sounds like it would be a great one. I'm all the way from New Zealand, which is why I'm a little bit late. I'm sorry about that. It's quite far. I'm Jewish through my mum, and my father's born and raised in Egypt, which means that I speak Egyptian Arabic, and I'm very good with my money. I've lived in America for the last 6 or 7 years, in New York, which is not really America, but and I've produced 2 Americans, so I think that makes me American by default. I'm a bit of a mongrel, as you could probably tell, with all these sort of nationalities going on, not just am I an American, but because my father was born and raised in Egypt, which is from the continent of... Thank you, which makes me an African-American. They never buy that in Harlem, though, funnily enough. No matter what I say. So I have an unusual career path. When I speak in film schools, I always have to sort of give a caveat that this is not necessarily the way to go about having a career in film, and in some ways that's the point, but that there isn't one way to doing things. But I started in the theatre and the performing arts as a actor, musician, and dancer. I know. It is true that I played in the New Zealand National Basketball League. It is also true that I was the youngest player drafted in to the NBL in that year, and that I was the shortest player in the history of the game to do that in the world. So, but I would like to say, and it's quite true, I could dunk a basketball. Just silence. I wasn't expecting that. I was maybe, sort of standing on your feet in one moment and applauding and just sort of the general excitement about that remarkable feat of a white man jumping. But be that as it may. At the end of a number of great experiences in theatre and the performing arts and music, I actually left at the peak of that and went and did a lot of humanitarian aid work and missions work in the Middle East, and I worked with the urban poor in Cairo, and I lived in a blind school in Beirut, Lebanon, and where I worked with rehabilitating people who had lost their sight during the 17-year civil war. I also stayed in Kurdistan in northern Iraq. I smuggled... this has not been recorded, is it? before I get my visa renewed. I smuggled medical supplies and Kurdish language Bibles from Cairo, where I was living, through Istanbul, Turkey, and down into northern Iraq and then into Kurdistan. I was walking around with an AK-47 Kalashnikov because we were being shot at. Saturday mornings was shooting practice, and then Saturday afternoon, because it was with an American organization, it was baseball. Shooting in the morning, baseball in the afternoon. No change there then. In New York anyway. So that was the start of an unusual journey for me, and I survived that and came back to New Zealand and to the performing arts, where I taught for a couple of years in a performing arts school. And I then went into television and film, where I've been for the last 15 years. For those of you that are struggling, the interpreter should be coming here soon, but I heard he's delayed, also from New Zealand, so as I said, quite a long way. I have an unusual title for today. Boy, your water's good here. This was what I brought with me, and this was what Dr. Greg gave me. That's all I'm saying. My title for today is called From Bewusstsein to Beirut by Boat. It's one of those titles one would imagine was created in the sheer absence of anything more sensible, and I can only agree. But I would like to look at the idea of a journey of reckless abandon and the idea of taking on the impossible. And I don't mean in a sort of Tony Robbins type way where you can motivate yourself to do the impossible. I literally mean taking on the impossible where you can't do something. So let's start with point number one, shall we? Bewusstsein. Anyone here speak German? Does anyone in America speak a second language? No! Bewusstsein. Let me start off by saying that I think there's a certain journey that we all go on in life, and one is a practical journey where you physically grow up and get taller, except for me. And some it can be a geographical journey. I left New Zealand 20 years ago, and I've lived in 6 countries in the last 20 years and filmed in 27 countries. So I've had a physical journey, one could say, a geographical journey. But there is also a spiritual journey. There's a journey of where we grow in our understanding of the world around us and of who we are in that world. And that's the journey I want to talk about a little bit, especially because, you know, you guys are all here because part of your journey is you wanted to learn, and you have, I'm hoping, some vision of where you feel you're meant to go and why you're here. In reality, half of you don't know why you're here nor where you're going. And that's okay, to be honest. That's part of what I want to talk about. So that journey, there's these stages you can talk about, like stages of faith, if you like. A lot of people have written about this. And there is one stage in particular, I'm not going to go through the stages for time, but there's one stage in particular that you find a lot of evangelical Christians stuck in, and they never move beyond it. And this stage is described by people who hold deep but unexamined convictions. And these are convictions they would, you know, argue vehemently about, passionately about, but they've never thought of them. It's because they're convictions that they were brought up with. It's part of the culture of the church that they grew up in, the parents that they had, and so on. And it's shaped the way they see the world. It's created a worldview, if you will. And their journey, in a sense, has stopped there, which is a real shame. There is an intriguing aspect of this journey, which is the idea that I'm going to use 3 German words to break this up, and I'm going to do this not to sound knowledgeable, because I'm not, but because it gives us a platform and a distance to talk about 3 very ordinary English words. So I'm going to start off with kennen and wissen, which in German is to know. Kennen is to know something, wissen is to know someone. Verstehen is the next word, which is to understand. And the wonderful Bewusstsein is to realize. But I'm going to break them down for you a little bit, because each one has a layer. So to know is something very basic, to get information about something. You all got to a point in your life where you knew the basic fact that at some point you're going to die. A little tragic. But when you discover that in the early years, it's not really too tragic, because, you know, you just generally understand that someone, you know, you're going to die. You might go through school and biology and actually understand in what way someone dies, the way the cells break down and all this sort of thing. So you might have an understanding that takes a bit more from you to go from that to knowing, you know, from kennen, wissen to verstehen. But Bewusstsein is different, because you may know that you're going to die one day. You may understand how generally that could happen. But when a doctor comes to you and announces that you have an operable cancer and you have 2 weeks to live, then all of a sudden, your realization, your Bewusstsein of the fact that you're going to die carries immense and different significance, and it alters your perspective. In other words, Bewusstsein is this state of realization. It's something that you gain through an experience that's deeply personal to you. The really interesting thing about Bewusstsein is it's not something you can get on your own. You can go and know something or understand something on your own. It's what you're doing here, hopefully, for those that do their homework. But Wurstsein, you can't. You can't get that. That needs something outside of you. Let's look now at point number two, the boat. I grew up sailing, which is, I mean, New Zealand's an island, so believe me, if you walk too far, you will end up sailing, or certainly in the water. And I've discovered a really interesting thing about sailing and about water in general. If you are out in the ocean and the waves get really big, generally the safest place to be is in a boat. If you can't be on land, of course. And to be honest, I found this true virtually 100% of the time. Funnily enough, the higher the waves, the more I feel the bewusstsein of that, the experiencing the reality of that. So what the heck was Peter thinking? You know, was it just that he was stupid? You know, he's in the boat at the time. The waves are getting high. And what does he want to do? The complete opposite. And I know that this story of Peter walking on the water, it's been told so many times. It has this familiarity to you where some of the meaning or the impact, I think, might be lost. And we've all had the sermon about, you know, how he looked at the waves and took his eyes off Christ and started to sink. And that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about what made him get out of the boat and take on the impossible. It certainly wasn't coming out at the back end of a Tony Robbins seminar. It wasn't that he felt that he could do that in of himself. It wasn't through sheer motivation. I think he had a bewusstsein. I think when you look at Peter, he started off with a very basic knowledge of God. He understood that from being Jewish and from his Hebraic cultural worldview, that there was a promised Messiah that was to come. He understood the issue of sin. He understood the need of repentance, the need of someone to come. He understood the sacrificial system. He had grown up with celebrating Passover and the retelling of that story of the blood that was placed on the doorposts and the angel of death passed by, and the idea of being saved by the blood, the idea of being saved by the sacrifice of a perfect male animal. Then he would have understood. He would have gone to Vestehen, the second level, if you like, and understood that Christ was the Messiah. You know, that in and of itself is pretty profound. But I think he got out of the boat because he had a bewusstsein, he had a revelation, he had an epiphany, if you will. He had a realization of what that meant, that Christ was the Messiah. Because for him in that moment, what that meant is that stepping out of a boat into a raging storm, because Christ was there, that was the safest place. That was the place to be. And it was a decision that had nothing to do with logic. It had nothing to do with physics, even. It had to do with a bewusstsein. It had to do with a realization that he could not get on his own. He had a spiritual revelation of who Christ was, and that where Christ was where he needed to be. And that when he was in this moment of great trouble, that even though it worked against his logic, where Christ was where he needed to be. That's powerful stuff. That's a journey that he went on that that took him to a place where he's walking on water. I think what's amazing about bewusstsein is simply the point that it's not something you can achieve on your own. You are certainly a part of that process, and the knowledge and the understanding is important, but that last part you can't do. I love, I'm a big fan of Tolkien and of The Lord of the Rings, and I think what's incredible about the story of Frodo is you get through all those three books, and which is, to be honest, an accomplishment for some of us. And he all the things that he goes through. And he gets right to the end. And he had, let's be honest, a fairly simple task. He just needed to drop a ring off. And I just love the fact that he gets all that way and he couldn't do it. How smart was Tolkien in the way that his writing was imbued with a Christian worldview, this understanding that these tasks that God draws us into to do, this calling he puts on our life individually, has to be tasks that we can't do on our own. Otherwise, why do we need God? And right at the end there, he couldn't do it. And, you know, I won't spoil it as to what happens for any of you that are still in book two. But, spring break after all, it's understandable. But he couldn't do it, and I think that's, you know, that's an amazing statement. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from that. So let me now take you to Beirut. Do you see how we've gone from Bewusstsein by boat to Beirut? Is that working for you? Receptive bunch, aren't we? See, Beirut is in Lebanon, and when I was living in the blind school, I have to be honest, it sounds like you think the kind of people that go and do this thing that, you know, that they're selfless, and certainly my intention was to go and help, but like it's hard work. And when I got to this blind school, because it was just after the 70-year civil war, they had a basement which they used as a bomb shelter. And after the war had ended, over time, a lot of the rubbish, the broken desks and just all this sort of stuff, just got shoved down into the basement. The basement wasn't needed as a bomb shelter anymore, so it just became a sort of a tip. And when I was there, I was the only person who could see. And the director of the school, he's the kind of guy that you would write into a film, like he was just almost a caricature. Like if you, I don't know, did you, I mean, in New Zealand when I grew up, we had milk bottles. Did you have that at some point in America? Right. So for those of you that remember, Greg. sorry, Dr. Greg. It was literally that, you know, that expression about milk bottom glasses or whatever. His glasses were so thick and so kind of curved and what have you. I mean, the guy was virtually blind, but he had these hilarious huge things on there, and you could see his eyes like magnified, squinting through these things. So he was no good, blind as a bat. However, because of that, I had to do a lot of the sort of manual stuff around the place, and I was painting the thing, and you know, looking after, you know, teaching people how to use a cane, you know, because a lot of these people were not born blind; they had become blind through explosions or, you know, mines and things like that. So there was a lot of physical, practical work, and I remember early on there was a guy called Nadim. And has anyone heard of echolocating? I just had to ask a tricky question that no one would know the answer to, so that I had time to have a drink. So thanks for that. Echolocating is amazing. I didn't know when I lived in Beirut that this existed until I came years. In fact, I think it was last year I saw a documentary on it. But there was this guy, Nadim, and he was an echolocator. Echolocators are people who, where they lost their sight, their other senses, which generally happens, are heightened, but with echolocators, they're heightened to an incredible degree, where they can sense objects around them through the way that sounds bounce off. And he was always doing this, because he would hear how that sound would go, hit an object, and come back. And I remembered and bear in mind, I didn't know that there was this thing called echolocating. I just am hanging with this guy called Nadim, who would walk me around and do this and tell me what was there. And you know, he would, I remember we walked past a tree and he'd go, okay, yep, tree, and then it'd be a lamppost, lamppost. I'm like, how do you know, hold on. How do you know the difference between a tree and a lamppost? He goes, they sound different. So, can't really argue with that. So, one time he blindfolded me and he said, let me show you around the school. And so he put the blindfold on and he's holding my arm and he starts doing this and he's like saying to me, okay, right, right, left, left, okay, straight ahead, right, right, left, left. And he goes, oh, stop, stop. So I stop and he's like giggling. And I'm thinking, you annoying little blind person. the things I'll say for a glass of water. And I stop and I go, what's so funny? And he says, okay, take your blindfold off. And I took my blindfold off and I was 2 inches away from a huge big wall. And then everyone around is tittering and what have you. So, you know, it was a great laugh at my expense, but you know, it taught me something. So that was fine. So one day I get asked to, by this guy with the milk bottom glasses to, would I mind awfully if I tidied up the basement? Now look, it's a difference between would you mind awfully tidying up the stage, maybe putting this chair over there, piece of paper here. This was like, would you move this rubble, these broken desks, and, you know, tidy up this entire basement? And I've got to tell you, my hard attitude at that point was not good. I would not have been able to be a prime example for humility and servanthood, or the poster child for, you know, missions work at that particular point. The language used was not of the kind that you'll find in many dictionaries. And I was really annoyed. And I was grumbling and I was moaning. And I was wishing that they were not only blind, but that they were deaf so that they couldn't hear what I was saying. And I walked down, and you go down these steps into the basement. And there's kind of an important thing you have to understand that even happens now in Lebanon, and particularly in Beirut. After 17 years of the civil war, it, you know, knocked out so much of the power grid. There was not, at that point, 24 hours of power. You had 2 chunks of 6 hours in the day where you would have power that was sustained. And then they would just cut it off. Now, for those people that had money, they would have a generator that they would turn on in the intervening periods. And otherwise, you just literally got candles out. And so going into the basement, you know, the first thing I did, obviously, was turn the light on, and whew, it all came on. Everything was cool. We were in the middle of one of those 6 hours with electricity, which was great. So I'm literally, have you ever been in that position where you are arguing with inanimate objects? I mean, I was lashing out. I had some good points. I got in some great jibes there, I tell you. But I was just moving these stupid things and grumbling about, you know, what was I doing here? You know, I was thinking of the kind of jobs I could have done. You know, some easy job, like, I don't know, a coroner. Surgery on dead people, you know? What's the worst that could happen? You know? You come home from a bad day. Honey, I gained one on the table today. So I'm moaning about the situation and I'm moving these things along. And then Nadim comes down. Now you've got to understand, Nadim was one of these people who had such a kind of positive, like he's one of those incredible people who you'd almost have to convince him he was blind. No, I'm not. What are you talking about? Didn't hear that. But he just had such this just an amazing sort of attitude. He didn't see, pardon the pun, his disability, and he operated in a wonderful, amazing way. So he comes bumbling down the stairs, one of those positive, happy people, which you don't want to meet when you're not in the same frame of mind. And he's like, "Hey, heard you could do us some help, you know." And I'm thinking, "Hey." You know, I mean, what am I going to say? You know, I'm thinking in my mind, well, Nadim, you're blind, you can't help me, you know, I've got this sorted. So I didn't say that because I didn't want to be impolite. And I thought I'd wait till now, 20 years later, where I could share that with you. But I said to him, Nadim, no, I'm fine, mate. No, it's all good, bro. Don't worry about it. There's only just, you know, a few tables around here. And he's like, no, there's not. It's like, what am I, stupid? And he goes, no, seriously, let me help. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so I say to him, so I tap the edge of the table that I'm carrying, and I said, you know, come forward, it's about, you know, X number of meters or whatever. And so he comes forward and he reaches out and he finds the edge of the table. So I'm saying to him, okay, you know, let's pick it up. Okay, and now I'm saying to him, all right, right, okay, back, left, you know. And we get a thing going here, it starts to work, and we're moving these tables and we're moving this stuff together, and the guy's blind, but we've figured out a way to make it work, and actually it kind of broke the ice on how I was feeling, and we started to laugh, and it was working, it was great. We get another table, and we're in the middle of moving this one, and all of a sudden, click. The power cut. And I'm downstairs in a basement that has no other source of light in Beirut, Lebanon, holding a table in the dark. I can't see a thing. And I stop. And Nadim says to me, what's happened? Because nothing's changed for him. And I said, the power's cut, I can't see. And there was this pause, and Nadim just softly says, you know, let me guide you. And he didn't say it with any tone or any kind of, he wasn't joking. He says, come on, we can do this, we can carry on. And he started doing this. And he started saying to me, you know, right, left. And we carried on in the dark, moving, you know, these tables. And I have to tell you, like, I had my own bewusstsein in that moment. As I'm being guided, you know, in the dark by a guy who can't see, and he is leading the way for me. And we got that thing cleared out. And it changed the way I saw things. I learned a number of things in that moment. Some of them were obvious, but let me pick up a few of them for you. One is that I had the most amazing experience of God's grace expressed to me when I deserved it the least. In other words, it was not because I was great. It was not because I had such a good, selfless attitude that God decided to bless me and teach me something. No, it was when I was the least deserving that he did that. He also used a means of teaching me that I could never have expected. I didn't see it coming. And thirdly, this bewusstsein was exactly as I describe it, in that it was at such a deep spiritual level that it's impossible to put into words, but it changed the way I saw things from there on out. So, today, what I want to say to you is really this, that the journey you go on has to be based not on what you can do. Your journey of seeking knowledge and understanding cannot be based on things that you alone can grasp. That there is this role that God plays in your life across the board in all that you do, that only he can do. And there's a humility that comes with that. If we think in our own intellectual might that we could grasp and understand God, then we've missed him entirely. It's like Tolkien talks about how you kill the thing you're analyzing through vivisection. So there is this starting point of understanding that God is bigger than us. outside of us in some ways, and yet wonderfully able to be so intimate with us. And what comes out of that Bewusstsein is this calling on your life to go and do something with the skills that he gave you. Some of you are going to be facing those choices soon when you graduate and what have you. And I would encourage you to look at life based on not what you can do, but based on taking on what you cannot do. And I reiterate to you, I do not mean cannot do in a sort of general sense of I'm trying to say it's a really hard thing, but I'm using that as an idiom or whatever. No, that you've impossibly, that you cannot do. Because in that moment, you are entirely reliant on God. And only then is God really real to you. Otherwise, he's a theory. Otherwise, he's a social construct, or he's something that you grew up with. You're one of those people with those deep but unexamined convictions, and when tested, it actually falls to pieces because it's not been real to you. The kind of choices I'm talking about are the ones that are illogical, that defy physics, that defy what seems sensible to you. Because to me, that's where you begin your journey in your relationship with God. That's actually where it gets really exciting. It's about coming to him with a reckless abandon, and it's the Isaiah commission, which I love, where the angel's saying, well, who can I send? And Isaiah says, I'll go, send me. You know, and then he takes that coal and he purifies him because he's going to be used as a vehicle, as a vessel to speak. So what God wants from you is the willingness, and he will do the impossible through you. And then you can never claim the glory for that. Isn't that cool? Because it wasn't you. It was something you couldn't do. And just like Isaiah, they prepared him once he was willing with the coal. Likewise, God will prepare you. But what's the one thing God can't do? He can't. It's your free will. It's your choice. Are you willing? If you see life in terms of your agenda of career goals or study goals, and that's the end, what happens when you get there? I mean, it's way more than that. That's not what it's about. But if you come to God with a reckless abandon and say, here I am, I'm willing to go, and trust him for how he's going to do it, trust him for the impossible, man, I tell you, you'll have some stories. But not only that, you'll have a Bewusstsein. You'll have a realization that about yourself and about the world around you that you could never have gotten any other way. So, I encourage you as you go out, even today, to look at the world in a different way. And I look forward to hearing your stories a long time from now. Let's pray, shall we? Father, I thank you that you love us as we are, not as we should be. That the starting point of our relationship with you is not based on us, but based on you. Lord, I thank you that you are intimately interested in every one of us here, that you gift us for a purpose, that you are willing to reveal that purpose to us who are willing to have that purpose revealed. I pray that you'd encourage us this morning with this idea of standing before you with reckless abandon and saying, here I am, use me, I'll go. Into whatever that is, whether that's accounting, whether that's a basement in Beirut, or walking on water. Lord, here we are, we'll go. You set the terms, you're in charge. And Lord, we thank you that you offer an experience that can never be put into words. And we love you for that. In your precious name, amen.